Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot. And I'm Max, and today I'm joined in the studio by Rory. And this week, we're going to be looking at three major political shifts, each raising a different question about how stable political systems really are. In the UK, Keir Starmer is facing growing political pressure following controversy around senior appointments, including scrutiny over Peter Mandelson and how decisions inside Downing Street are being made and overseen. Then, we go to Europe, where after 16 years in power, Viktor Orban has lost office in a decisive election shock, with Peter Magyar now set to lead a government with a projected parliamentary supermajority. And finally, back in the UK, we look at the fragmentation of the right between the Conservatives, Reform UK, and emerging Restore Britain, messaging associated with figures such as Rupert Lowe. So let's get into it. So we start in Westminster, where this is no longer just a political controversy, but a test of government control and credibility. At the centre is Peter Mandelson, whose appointment and surrounding scrutiny has triggered wider questions about Keir Starmer's judgment, vetting process, and accountability for his government's decisions here. So Keir Starmer has, in the past, built his political identity before coming into office on this idea of professionalism and competence, but this situation severely tests that reputation, not necessarily through wrongdoing, but through perception of control and judgment. So, Rory, what matters more politically? Whether Keir Starmer knew about these, Peter Mandelson failing the vetting process and didn't do anything about it, or the fact that he wasn't even informed in the first place by his own government.
What do I think is worse?
Yeah.
I think arguably what's worse is the fact that he didn't know about it, because that shows that it's a failure of the British state, not just of the morons at the top. It shows that is the true, like, national security risk. I mean, if he... I have my suspicions. If Keir Starmer did not know. Well, I mean, it's just so stupid because it's impossible. You can't say, oh, what, this is worse than that, because that didn't happen. He knew because he got grilled about it in September. He knew so much in September that he sacked him, and yet he didn't have any investigation into the vetting. He didn't have any interest in the vetting. That just seems totally, I mean, stupid. I mean, look, this government is stupid. Keir Starmer is stupid. But I think it's dangerous if he's that stupid that he wouldn't ask someone or check with them that the vetting was actually approved. If they lied to him, that's another thing. Yes, it shows that he's got no control of his own office, let alone the cabinet and the government and the country as a whole. So I think either one is bad, but you can't really
pick one or the other.
Well, you can't really pick one or the other, because one of the options is, like, it's just an impossibility. It can't have actually happened. So, I mean, who's wrong here? Who's in the wrong? Keir Starmer. He needs to take responsibility. I think he should go. I mean, the poor man, he's just getting so many, rightfully, he's getting so much backlash for all the terrible things he's done. So, I mean, it's quite satisfying to watch all the arguments that he put to Boris Johnson in 2022. Obviously, all the
about him misleading Parliament.
About him misleading Parliament. Yeah. So Keir Starmer misled Parliament in two ways. Actually, we'll get back onto how he misled Parliament, and I'll explain it later. But to answer your question directly, one of the options can't have happened, and if it happened, that would be a huge risk. The other option is also a risk, but to be honest, it's not a surprise considering how useless this Prime Minister is.
Yeah, and what do you think? What do you think the reason was behind Mandelson's actual appointment then as US ambassador? I mean, if Keir Starmer did know about him failing the vetting process, then why on earth do you think he would have appointed him if he had known that if Mandelson, his relationship with Epstein had been leaked, the potential backlash, he would have known that sort of would have come back on him, don't you think?
Yeah, well, unless he hadn't been reading the news for about half a decade, Keir Starmer knew about the risks. He knew about the links to Peter Mandelson, and all the controversies he's been in. For God's sake, he's been sacked at least twice already, put well by Diane Abbott, though I disagree with her. But, like, it's just so incomprehensibly stupid that he can't have done this, or he can't have asked, or he didn't know about it, because you did know. The country knew. So you should have known, considering that you represent the country. So I think that's really stupid. I think that's really scary as well. And I think if you've got a prime minister as incompetent and stupid as that, he should resign, even if it means having someone arguably worse, like Ange or Ed Miliband or whatever they want to, whatever moron they're going to put up the pedestal next. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's quite crazy, but like, we would have known about this. He should have known about this. I have no idea why on earth you would appoint someone such as that, but in hindsight, seeing all the stupidity, seeing all how just all the dilly-dallying this government's doing, I mean, I can sort of see the kind of trail of thought they must have gone down, and it's not one that relies on common sense at all.
So why do you think he hasn't resigned then already?
I think he's a power freak.
You think he thinks that he can reverse what he's already done by using his position?
Well, I mean, I respect his confidence, of course. He's not going to be able to do that. I'm saying he's gone by the end of May. I'm saying he's probably gone after the King's Speech, so they'll give him a King's Speech. Oh, no, we're not doing any of this because you've changed Prime Minister. But let's rejoice because you finally got Starmer, the Farmer Harmer, out. I don't know why he's clinging on to power. I mean, this raises suspicion. Obviously, people think, oh, maybe it's not Keir Starmer trying to keep himself in power. Maybe it's the people that is around Keir Starmer trying to keep themselves in power, and so they're just using Keir Starmer as a human shield. And that's not the role of the Prime Minister. And he should just be brave, go out there, do what's right for himself, for the country, just for everything, and just resign.
And if... I mean, I don't... I personally don't think he's going to resign just now. I think if the May elections go horribly wrong, which, as we've said in previous episodes, we believe that will happen. Don't be worried.
I'm strongly confident.
Yeah, we strongly believe. Then it's highly likely that he will obviously resign.
I don't think he will resign, actually.
You don't?
I don't think he'll resign.
Oh, you think there's going to be
a challenger in the party room?
And who do you think is going to be the challenger? Could there be multiple challengers, would you say?
Well, one's going to stick their hand up.
Well, Ange
is going to go.
Ange is going to go.
And
for it.
I mean, if Ange goes, then it's a matter of do other people go for it?
Does but surely no one would.
Does West go for it? Does whatever?
Not David Lammy.
David, oh God, don't even get me started. David Lammy. Shabana, though we love her, Shabana's not going to. Shabana won't go. Actually, she might go for it, but I mean, there's a greater chance that pigs could fly than Shabana Mahmood become Prime Minister as a Labour politician. So. She's a bit of a lost cause in Labour electoral circles. But I don't think Keir Starmer could resign. I don't think he will resign. But if he does, then that's a clear field. And obviously, you'll probably get more candidates. But if there's one candidate, Ange, I think, who challenges the leadership, which I think she will, then it's only a matter of other people go in. And I actually don't think... If Ange goes for it, I don't think a lot of other people will go for it. So it's a matter of whether he resigns or not, and I don't think he will resign. So I'm more swayed towards Angela.
Do you think that no... Is the reason why you think that not many people would go for it if Angela Rayner went for it because of the support that she could potentially have? Is that what you're trying to say?
I think if she challenges the leadership, that's more of a kind of one-on-one contest rather than the leadership
herself.
Being vacant.
Yeah, but she's got her own scandal herself.
Well, they all do, so...
Yeah, of course.
It's not really a detriment to her because it's kind of an even playing field in that regard. Let's go through it, what the grievances for all the candidates are, wrapped up in one of our episodes that we did a few weeks ago. But put simply, Ed Miliband lost an
Failed
election.
Failed already, yeah.
Wes Streeting links to Peter Mandelson, but he's more of the same, so they won't do him. Shabana Mahmood, too right-wing, too bit right-wing. Reformish for them. And then Angela, obviously we've got Ange, she's got a tax scandal, but that's probably not the worst.
Not the worst.
I mean, it's probably the worst thing out of all of them, but I don't know, she just has the charisma to kind of ride through it. And then who else have you got? David, he's lost hope, no one's going to vote for him. And then you've probably got some other Muppets. But I think if it's a challenge, it's more of a one-on-one rather than if the leadership becomes vacant, then more people kind of put their hats in the ring. They feel a bit more confident. But also it's kind of a leadership challenge feels a bit more confrontational. I don't think there's going to be a kind of big brawl for it.
And what do you think of Keir Starmer's decision to sack Sir Ollie Robbins and then obviously have him speak against him? That's backfired quite
good
badly,
on Ollie.
Hasn't he?
Good on Ollie. I mean, obviously Ollie's not supposed to be political at all. He's not political. He served in the May government. Oh, we didn't serve in the May government. He served for the May government. Same with Keir Starmer's government, God forbid. I think he's been the fool guy, and there have been too many civil servants that have acted as fool guys for Keir Starmer's mistakes. Last time I checked, it was Keir Starmer who appointed Peter Mandelson. Last time I checked, it was Keir Starmer who misled the House, him saying, oh, well, we know confidently about this stuff, when you did not confidently know about this stuff. You're also in the ministerial code, you're supposed to update the House when you get to correct the information. And
yes,
seeing the reports published a few weeks ago, he has still not corrected his statement made a few months ago. So according to Keir Starmer, the same is still true. Therefore, he's totally confident everything was right, apparently, according to actual protocol. So it's Keir Starmer, basically. It's all his responsibility. I don't know why Ollie Robbins is taking the hit. I mean, it's been the same Morgan McSweeney, Sue Gray, Chris Warmland that Keir Starmer's always going for. They've all been sacked for Keir Starmer's mistakes, and he's going to frame it as, oh, they didn't tell me all this stuff. No, your job is to know all this stuff, so you need to be proactive and go to them if you don't know any of this stuff. So, I mean, it just highlights and is the kind of image and epitome of Keir Starmer's incompetence, his stupidity, his irresponsibility, and, well, you know, just the lack of, or the inability just to control a basic team of, like, top government officials. And I think that's dangerous. But, I mean, that just kind of sums Keir Starmer up in an act, really.
What, as in being quite spineless?
Well, I mean, okay, well, yes, he's weak, irresponsible, he can't, like, he's irresponsible, he can't take responsibility for his government's mistakes. Like, when bad things happen in certain departments, normally government
ministers
resign.
Well, yeah, he doesn't take responsibility for anything, really. Just blames on other people, gives them the sack instead of...
Well, that's exactly what's happened here.
Yeah.
And in that respect, I feel really bad for Ollie Robbins because it's not really his fault, is it?
Yeah. I think it's quite disgraceful, really. I mean, I think Keir Starmer, in the past, whenever he's been talking about always what happened with Boris Johnson, he's loved to jump on the bandwagon there. And now that this is happening to him...
Jump on the bandwagon, yeah.
Now that this is happening to him, I mean...
Well, I mean, I was
ironic,
very satisfied
really.
When Kemi Badenoch used those words. I think it was, is it one rule for him or one rule for... Is it, it's one rule for him and one rule for everyone else. It's kind of, I don't know, it's a bit ironic considering he's on the opposite side of the situation that he put Boris Johnson in. And I think that kind of summed it up in a word, which was satisfying to watch.
Yeah, and do you think that, especially in the elections now, that Labour, this whole vetting scandal is going to have more of an effect on the elections and can have could change a lot about what could actually happen, perhaps?
I don't think in the grand scheme of things a lot is going to change, because what Labour are polling average about 18% now, 17%, but like I don't know who on earth those people are. I don't know where those people
have a word with them.
Well, I mean, they need a few words for them, but I don't know what kind of treatment they're receiving or what planet they're living on, because the country is not in a good spot with these bunch of crooks and idiots. So I don't think they are obviously the diehard Labour supporters. They are the ones. I don't think you've seen the same for the Conservatives. I don't think the Greens or Reform are really going to whittle down their support much more. So I don't think they're kind of at rock bottom, so to speak. So I don't think this is actually going to kind of persuade even more people. But I think the general point that I'm trying to make is this government has done a lot of negative. We've done a lot of things with negative consequences, and I don't think people are particularly... I don't think this is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back for kind of people's genuine or general perception of the government, but I think it just does highlight kind of what this government has brought, and I think it obviously dissuades some voters, but it's not going to... There have been worse things, basically, and this isn't as bad a thing, so this is probably not going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak.
And in terms of thinking about just the appointment in general, I just want to say that what skills does Peter Mandelson, aside from all of the his ties with Jeffrey Epstein, but what could he actually have, as in, brought? Why would Keir Starmer have appointed him? As in, is it just because he's friend?
Or I don't know.
Has he got a good relationship with the US?
I've literally zero clue.
I think it's quite a stupid decision.
My kind of theory, and as bonkers as it is that, maybe I'm going to put Peter Mandelson, a known friend of convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, to be the ambassador for a major country, which I also know whose leader had friendship and links with Jeffrey Epstein. So I don't know if they're pen pals or pals because they are friends with Jeffrey Epstein, but I actually just don't. I don't understand the rationale. I mean, you're probably going to need... Well, in World War II, they needed Enigma. I mean, they needed codebreakers to break the Enigma. In 2026, you're going to need, like, absolute experts to understand the trail of thought that this so-called lawyer has in appointing paedophile associates to top ministerial jobs.
Yeah.
But I think, actually, just trailing on that point, half of this, I mean, the core background of this is half of this problem is that he's a paedophile with Jeffrey Epstein. I would argue that's bad enough.
Yeah.
But with the greatest respect, that's probably less than half the problem. The big elephant that we need to address in the room is that he's an associate of a Russian defense company, Systema, and he's being put as the ambassador between the special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States with the Five Eyes. This is one of the largest intelligence organizations in the world. So you cannot have a person who is associated with Russian defense companies overseeing these relations and this intelligence. That's a national security risk, not just for the United Kingdom, but for the United States as well. I think that is extremely terrifying. That is the main problem with this. That's what I'm more concerned about. Obviously, the victims of Jeffrey Epstein have more than enough to be angry about. I totally agree with them. That is terrible and abhorrent in itself. But the defense, I mean, if you could make it even worse, then you add the Systema links and everything. That is just kind of the cherry on the top of this ice cream sundae of doom that this government has created. I think that is... I mean, it's detrimental to the image of the government, but it's detrimental to the national security as well.
I think it also raises a question as well about, obviously, the way that ministers are obviously appointed to office and the security checks that they need to undergo. So, I mean, personally, I think that it's obviously a bit lax, isn't it, really, in terms of the way they're doing it now, obviously letting, as you said, a paedophile associate into a top office and being able to... not only like work with the US, and I mean obviously it's quite a special relationship between the UK and the US, and obviously Mandelson had no right to be able to hold that sort of, it's quite an esteemed position, really, as an ambassador to the US.
So well, I think that's the most important
So I think that we're just going to be tighter. I mean, the communications go better. I mean, if Keir Starmer does go, and a obviously
inevitably it's a when, because he's not going to be prime minister forever.
Yeah, of course.
So it's a when.
Yeah, fine. Okay. So when Keir Starmer does go, then obviously whoever comes in next is going to obviously have to appoint their own cabinet, unless they might keep some of the people in the current cabinet. But
yeah,
it was me, probably just sack most of them. Maybe Shabana might stay there, you know.
Shabana's going to be my
Rachel
Labour
Reeves,
Prime Minister.
You're gone.
Rachel, just gone. Leave. David, sacked. Who else? Ed. Bridget's been growing on me over the past few weeks. Ed, he's not my least favourite.
He's not that bad. There
are certainly more rotten apples in that bunch than Ed Miliband.
Who would you say is?
David Lammy. He doesn't know what he's doing. Hate with a capital H.
Yeah, I mean, if David Lammy ends up running, then there's a zero chance.
If David Lammy becomes Prime Minister, I don't know. That'll be a question for another episode.
Just leave the country.
Well, I've already left the country, so I mean, it doesn't really make a huge difference in the grand scheme of things. But I don't think I'd be coming back anytime soon if David Lammy became Prime Minister.
And do you think that? Okay, so we've obviously spoken about when Keir Starmer could potentially go, and obviously the issues, obviously with the vetting process as well. But do you think this is just like a broad question?
Yeah.
Just for you, like, just this is just not just looking at this.
Fine. This I'll Labour ask you this question
government.
After.
Okay. Do you think that a government that is initially built on this idea of competence can survive sustained questions about its own
incompetence?
I'm talking about any government. Just this Labour government.
Okay, fine.
Then do you think a government that builds its whole manifesto on competence and efficiency can survive in any form, however well they do in a certain aspect, just because of sustained questions about its control in one specific area?
That's a very complex question. I would say.
So do you want to break it down or?
No, okay, fine. Okay. I think if a government is elected on efficiency, and if they're not being efficient, i.e. they're not doing something well in a certain department, or they're not, like, they're making losses in that department, that's not efficient. I think that the breaches that manifesto, so to speak, and that's probably a lie to the British public, I'll make you unpopular. So you do lose political capital. Does it get into the capital deficit? Well, it depends how severe it is. I mean, constant questioning, that does eat away at support and sympathy and all of that. But I think it can survive if in mild cases. But if it's repeated, if it's unsurprising, which is what this government's doing, obviously you want to be general, but I'm going to link it back to this government.
Of course.
That can't survive, and it won't survive. And I mean, it's knives out for this government, at least, because their core manifesto promise was on honesty, competence, and, well, restoring trust, basically. So less than 2 years into the term, they've lost trust, they have lost competence, they've lost honesty. I think that shows that they have failed. That showed they have lied. That showed that they have, well, they've been unable to do what they've set out to do.
Well, and they've misled the whole population, haven't they, really?
Well, I mean, in all honesty, that's what they've done. I'm trying to beat around the bush, but the general point is that's what they've done. I don't think they should survive. I mean, it's despicable what they're doing. And they're all saying, oh, it's part of the plan. Oh, we've got, it's fully funded, it's fully costed.
Oh,
well,
God.
The economy is completely on fire. Like, don't worry about it, guys. No, everyone's worrying about it.
No, but talk about this fully funded, fully costed, but yet, wages are rising. Will unemployment increase?
Wages is rising. This no, is... they're not. Unemployment is rising. Yes, it is. Inflation is falling. No, it's not. Check your figures. Interest rates are being cut. No, they're not. They're staying the same. So I think, I mean, also, like, that shows just, they don't have any information. Like, they're putting out, they're completely, like, churning out incorrect facts. That is kind of, that's misleading the population. That just completely goes against any principle of honesty they had.
Yeah, I think the leader is so important for any government, really. Like, the leader has to be charismatic, to fully back its own decision. I think this idea of U-turns, it it's just not. You've got to get it right. You have to get it right in the first place, or you just have to go, honestly.
Oh, yeah, well, don't even get me started. I don't think Keir Starmer is exactly the man who should be telling Kemi Badenoch that she made the mother of all U-turns. No, you are the mother of all U-turns, Sir Keir, because you're making all these U-turns. So, what are we on? I think we're on 18 or 17, 19? Are we above the 20 mark yet? I don't know. But I must say, the U-turns in themselves, they're good. Like, thank God we've scrapped the Chagos surrender deal. I mean, I was totally out against that. Yeah. That was my first grievance with David Lammy. We've got a long history. But I think it's just half of it is what they've U-turned. I disagree with what they were originally going forward. So a U-turn, that is obviously good. But the fact that you're not getting it right the first time around, or you're a government who's too kind of in touch politically rather than economically, or kind of you're not strong, that is concerning. And in that respect, that's embarrassing, and it's just weak. And I think that's kind of the word that's going to sum this government up. Boring, weak, liars, useless. I mean, just those sort of words. And I think maybe that's why Sir Keir is trying to power on, because he wants to change it. But I don't have a lot of hope for him.
There's no going back, really, when his approval rating is worse than Boris Johnson. And because public trust is so important.
He's the most unpopular prime minister. More unpopular than Sunak. I don't know if he's
I don't think Rishi Sunak
maybe
did
trust,
a great...
Maybe trust is a bit more unpopular, but I guess it's only a matter of time before Keir is as well.
Okay, let's just address that then. Why do you think Rishi Sunak's approval rating is so low? Is it just because what he inherited? Because I don't think he didn't do a bad job.
He turned a terrible job into a bad job. I phrased that incorrectly. He turned a terrible situation into a pessimistic, less optimal thing. So he made significant progress.
But progress is progress.
But at the end, at the end of the day, he didn't really able to recoup those losses.
Well, it's all about what he inherited, really. I mean, Labour can blame all they want.
I mean,
if
we're going into the hypotheticals and these counterfactuals and the what-if scenarios, if Liz Truss never became party leader, well, then you'd have economic credibility. At worst, you'd probably be, I'd say, maybe sub 250 seats. It might even be a hung parliament. I don't know. But I think what's been the main problem, I think it was Liz Truss, or more specifically, the hastiness of Liz Truss's budget. I've said earlier in this podcast, a few months ago, probably even, that I think her general philosophy was correct, and I agree with it. Did it too quick. It shocked the markets too much. If she did it over four or five budgets, then you'd probably have her still be prime minister.
She was so eager that obviously that was her downfall in the end. She just did everything at once, really. Didn't even think about how the markets
would react. She was a visionary, and that's the most polite way of saying it. She had big ideas, and she was quite...
See, Rishi Sunak was more realistic. I mean, he had like a 5-point plan about what he was actually going to do. As in, obviously, Stop the Boats was in there as well. And obviously, if you think about it, when a government writes up the list of everything that they're going to try and achieve, how much of that are they realistically going to do? As in, you might get a bit of progress.
It depends on the competence and the efficiency of the government. And for this government, they are extremely low, which is obviously not ideal. It's not ideal. So, obviously, if I was leading a government, let's hope one day, of course, my priorities, better economy, basically just a better country, a country that just works. Like, I go to all these places around the world. I go to Singapore. I live in Singapore. Everything works. The streets are clean. All the public services arrive on time. There's no traffic. Everything's okay. Everything's fine. It's a bit utopic. So then that just contrasts with central London. It's just a bit gloomy, really. Nothing works. There's roadworks. There's what do you want to call it? Potholes everywhere. So, I mean, it's not... You just want a country that works. And in every scenario or every kind of field, for this government just doesn't work.
Now we're moving on to Hungary, where the political system has just experienced a major shock. After 16 years in power, Viktor Orban has been removed from office in a decisive election result. The opposition, led by Peter Magyar, is projected to secure a two-thirds parliamentary majority, giving it the ability to implement wide-ranging reforms. So, what can we say then about Viktor Orban then? So, Viktor Orban, for those of you who don't know listening in, so he governed Hungary since 2010. His government was focused on reshaping constitutional and institutional structures. He obviously just lost his lost office in a decisive election result. And in terms of why Orban lost, Rory, he's obviously talking about his message has been less effective in this campaign than it was in previous times. And his message is weakened because he's mainly been focusing on the Ukraine war instead of, obviously, Hungary itself.
Yeah.
So just a question for you to open up. Do you know a lot about Viktor Orban? What do you think about him? You know, just well, a quick question for you.
Obviously, I don't know like him personally.
Of course,
What I do know is that he is basically what you would say is kind of that populist right wing of Europe, obviously with kind of Giorgia Meloni as well. So he was really integral to actually what got through and what didn't get through in the European Parliament.
Yes.
Yes, Ukraine has been a big part of why he lost. But I think another big reason why he's lost but is the economic crises that are facing Hungary at the moment. Like, he has racked up significant amounts of debt. His refusal to work with or cooperate with the European Union has meant that crucial funding, I think 80 billion euros, has been withheld. So that's money that he really needs, hasn't been able to like get to him. It's been frozen because of certain other things he's done, like his posture on Russia, Russian oil and Ukraine. And that has really annoyed a lot of voters. So that's sort of arguably got quite a big... that's had big sway.
Because, of course, he was one of the most prominent EU leaders taking positions closer to Putin on these international issues.
Yeah.
And his... Obviously, do you think... This is just another question for you. Do you think that this is a rejection of Orban himself as a leader, or the political system that he spent 16 years building?
I don't think it's a rejection of the system, so to speak. I think it's a rejection of his government. Obviously, a lot of people have thought that his government's been very corrupt. I mean, that's how we've seen Peter Magyar rise to prominence, because his wife, I think, was in some sort of fraud scandal. He resigned from Fidesz, and then he joined the teaser party. I think it's the Respect and Freedom Party in Hungarian. Or the Respect and Freedom, rather. I think it's basically been the image of the government. I don't think it's the electoral system's played a huge role in this election.
Yeah.
I think it's more the policies that Viktor Orban has advocated for, the corruption, so to speak, and the withholding of significant European funding being withheld as well. I think that's really cut through to voters. And I think that's kind of why, well, that's the main reason why this election has been terrible for Viktor Orban. That's elevated Peter Magyar to have a parliamentary supermajority in Budapest.
Yeah, and talking about his supermajority, just a bit about Peter Magyar for our listeners. So he was a former insider within governing political system. So that obviously means that he has experience.
He has experience
working in government, really. Apart from you mentioned his wife's scandal that forced him to resign.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention a bit more on what happened there? No?
No, I don't really know much more about
you
that.
You don't?
But
okay.
I just did a little bit of research. That's what I've scratched off the surface.
Okay, so his wife's had a scandal before. You know, most politicians always have something going on. But so he campaigned successfully across rural and urban areas. So that obviously shows that he has the backing of not only workers in the urban areas, but also potential farmers in rural areas as well, which is obviously quite important. I mean, I know, Rory, you're nodding a lot, so you're obviously...
Yeah.
You like farmers. Yeah.
I am a farmer.
Is it your grandparents?
Yeah. Oh, my grandpa. Yeah.
Grandpa. So you take pride in that, in farmers being recognised, wouldn't you say? If a leader was appealing to you, would you say, in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that draws me to the Conservatives. I think they're really advocating for, I'm not going to say my type of people because I'm not fully involved in farming, but I have a stake, especially in their family farms tax, as my family does have farms. And so that is an issue that really cuts through to me because that directly affects me. But obviously I'm not Hungarian, so that doesn't really have a sway on my kind of, actually I don't have a lot of opinions in Hungary really.
And in terms of what the opposition offered, because of course it's important to look at where it all went wrong for Viktor Orban. But of course, talking about the opposition, so I'm just going to touch on two of their policies that the opposition were campaigning for. And that was an anti-corruption mandate. So they wanted to introduce more accountability for misuse of public power, which is obviously ironic because obviously Keir Starmer is misusing his own public power now. And their attempt, obviously, Roy, you mentioned before about there's obviously been persistent criticism of corruption within Orban's government. And if Maggi is offering this more accountability for obviously misusing public power in a sense that can be seen as not speaking up for the public's best interest, then I think it's good that people are being held accountable for.
Totally.
Yeah. And in terms of his European alignment, he wants stronger cooperation with the EU and a recalibrated foreign policy direction. So I think with Peter Maggi, I don't think he's going to be as closely aligned with Vladimir Putin as Orban was.
Oh, definitely not. He's very, I don't want to say cozy because that makes it sound like it's a bad thing, but he's very much in European circles. This is very much a win for the European Union more than anyone else.
Yeah, that's obviously going to create stronger relations with other leaders in the EU if they are aligned about a certain issue, particularly the conflict of Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah.
And obviously that can benefit Hungary in many ways in terms of obviously trade as well, which is obviously quite important. And if we think of people who want to talk about the cost of living and want to address the sort of pressures. I mean, I don't know if you were with us for the Mamdani episode that we did in the Michaelmas term.
Well, I don't think I was.
You weren't there. So we were talking a lot about how he wanted to talk about the cost of living. It's similar to Zach Polanski, really, and that sort of leader who wants to obviously appeal to the population and have these healthcare and education reforms being their top priorities.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite important as well that Maggi is talking about the people instead of obviously Orban. 16 years obviously has to end eventually. Roy, do you think this was the right time for him to go? Do you think that?
Well, I mean, going into such a crucial kind of stage, obviously the US isn't as involved as it once was in Ukraine, and so the EU's really got to be strong in its support for Ukraine. And I think the toppling of Orban, arguably the most significant roadblock to aid reaching Ukraine. Well, he is the most significant roadblock because obviously the unanimity, the strict unanimity that Brussels approaches with huge loans, that 80, I think is 80 billion, maybe $200 billion even, of Russian, frozen Russian assets being given to Ukraine, that obviously they couldn't do that, so they did it through joint debt. But that got vetoed by Hungary. So as far as Ukraine is concerned, this needed to happen now because the support and the economic and militarily and the rhetoric coming from the US is uncertain. So the EU's got to be quite strong. It's got to be quite assuring for Ukraine. And I think having Orban be kicked out and replaced by someone who's much more compliant, much more cooperative with the EU, I think that's certainly something that needed to happen, and it probably needed to happen now. On the 13th of February 2026, Rupert Lowe officially founded Restore Britain as a political party. It is being described as being right-wing to far-right, and it's split from Reform UK. Obviously, Rupert Lowe was suspended from Reform UK on suspected bullying allegations. The party is, well, what you would think from a very ultra-conservative, right-wing to far-right party. So we are going to go through some of the policies, whether we agree with them or not, and give our final verdict on whether this is actually a party that deserves to have an average of, what, nearly 10% of the polls, according to some Find Out Now polls, which are very skewed to Reform. So that's quite credible, to be honest, for this sort of organisation. So my first one for you, Max, not my first policy for Restore Britain, sorry. The large-scale deportation of people in the United Kingdom without legal status, basically illegal immigrants.
Large-scale deportation.
Mass deportation.
Okay, so that you're saying they're illegal?
Yeah.
But okay, so...
without legal status.
In theory, the correct answer, not the correct answer, but what I would probably do is have that mass deportation.
I
feel like there has to be some sort of check about where these migrants are really coming from. Because I don't feel like it'd be right to deport them back to a place where there is their capacity to almost live a prosperous life is stopped really by potential, I don't know, conflict, economic crises, or obviously war and conflict as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's important as well, because obviously there's a lot of competition happening now for jobs due to a lot of these illegal immigrants and legal as well migrants, but we're not talking about them, we're talking about the illegal immigrants. And I think that could be leading to a lot of unemployment right now in the UK, because potentially these migrants can come over and do certain jobs that some of the population perhaps don't have the skills to be able to do.
No.
So I feel like that would perhaps be my way of thinking, but also looking at what the situation would be if we were to deport them back.
Yeah, but fundamentally, do you think that illegal immigrants should be deported if they illegally enter the country?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Because if it's illegal, then yeah. If they're legal, perfectly fine by me. You know, you've done all the checks.
Yeah.
You haven't, yeah.
That's... fine. Okay, next policy. Now, this is quite specific.
Okay.
Calling a referendum on reinstating the death penalty. Now, this is not just about the death penalty. They imply that they support the death penalty, but it's the calling of a referendum on it. Would you call a referendum? Or support a calling of a referendum?
I would not call a referendum for the death penalty.
So I think
there is a reason why the death penalty is no longer legal in this country.
Why is that? Pin that down.
Okay, why do I think the death penalty is not allowed? Because no one should... Okay, we're getting quite ethical here, but if someone killed another person,
yep.
Okay, theoretically, people would just say, oh yeah, they should have the death penalty. But potentially you don't know, really. That person might not deserve to die just because of that one indecision.
So you don't think that if someone kills a life,
they had a mental disorder? Should they deserve to die?
What if the
person
they killed also had a mental disorder?
Well, now we're getting into the hypothetical. So anything can happen now in this sort of
You're the one that you said.
It's
that.
Quite difficult to talk about something that I haven't actually seen.
Okay,
in
if they're a psychopath, fine. Okay, put it this way: if they're a psychopath, are you going to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds keeping them in those kind of rooms with like white cushions everywhere? Isolation, that sort of thing. Would you put them in there for the rest of their life?
Yes.
A mentally ill person?
If they've killed someone, yes.
Yeah, okay, fine. So why would you put them through that misery?
So you're saying that death is salvation then, if I was going to lock them up for the rest of their life?
No, I'm saying it's expensive.
Okay, all right. So you're thinking.
So I'm thinking a life penalty is expensive. If you're thinking ultra efficiency,
so you're thinking it's more expensive to house these murderers than just.
Yes, because you think about it. You need to feed them, you need electricity, you need security for them. If you kill them, what is only like.
So you would call. So you would call referendum.
I'd call a referendum. I'm all for calling referendums.
Just you don't think it would go. You don't think it would pass.
Well, I mean, like in all honesty, what's the point of democracy? You gotta. That's where people give their votes. So why wouldn't you not have a referendum?
That's a good point. Yeah.
So that's my rationale behind a referendum. As far as what the referendum is on, how would I vote? Well, obviously that's much more ethically that's more of a dilemma. I'm much more pro death penalty than you. I'm not saying that I'm outright pro death penalty.
I know you're anti it.
I can sense that you're anti it. I'm just saying I'm not as anti as you. I'm more in the kind of swing voters. I'm, in all honesty, I'm probably leaning more towards the death penalty because A, it's expensive, but look, one murder, as terrible as it is, that's you. I mean, how do I phrase this? Let's go with Axel Rudakabana, for instance.
Okay.
No words could describe how abhorrently bad and negative that creature is. Killed three young girls in Southport in July 2024. I think, so that's not one, not two, but three. Three innocent girls. I think he should get the death penalty. I think he's a prime example of someone who I think these people would think should get the death penalty. And on that, I mildly agree. Because he's an absolute nutcase. He's a danger. He's just an outright danger. So what's the point? Like, if there's a threat to democracy, if there's a threat to a, let's go with the computer system, you're obviously going to delete the threat, aren't you? You're going to get rid of the threat. So I don't really understand all these people. Oh, especially, don't even get me started. This is the type of thing that the green lunatics would say, oh, what about his human rights? What about the human rights of the three girls that he killed? I mean, it's ridiculous and it's despicable that they are defending such a monstrous creature like Axel Rudakabana, and he's one of many, for God's sake. So I think in this instance, yes, he should get the death penalty. I think this should be highly regulated. I think it needs to go through. I can't just be like, oh, you've killed a girl, death penalty for you. I don't think it can't be that kind of slick and quick. Obviously, it's going to be sort of, I was going to go through a few judges, getting a government approval from the Justice Secretary or something. Just, it's obviously a rare instance, but it's got, I think they should have that option because obviously, I mean, it probably won't dissuade people because these people are probably suicidal. These people want to kill everyone else. So I think, actually explaining it to you, I probably do support reinstating the death penalty.
Okay.
So I do think that there should be a referendum for it.
Do you not think that retribution is wrong, though?
What is retribution?
A life for a life. An eye for an eye is...
Yeah, oh,
is this
well,
in the Bible?
No, I don't think it's wrong.
You don't think it's wrong? Okay, all right.
Well, no, I have the thought process, if someone punches me, I'm going to punch them back. It's the same thing. Principally, it's the same thing. I'm not going to be kissed on and say, oh, you punched
but
me. But
surely...
We can all negotiate.
Surely you wouldn't... This is okay.
I have no respect for people who kill other people.
No. I'm talking about the punching analogy you gave.
Okay, fine.
If someone punched you, why would you punch back? Just an escalator.
I don't care if I escalate it.
You could.
Can't punch. They are no. I'm not walking around with people thinking that they can punch me and it's okay. No, if they punch me,
just stare them down.
Stare them down.
Yeah.
Stare them down. Okay, we'll see how that goes.
They're not going to punch you if they know that you. If you're not going to, the only reason someone would ever punch you is try and provoke you. If you don't give them that response.
That's one of the reasons.
If you don't give them that response.
Okay, fine. Well,
then...
there's two sides of the coin. You either, I don't know, you do your weird eye movement thing like Paddington Bear where he stares someone down and doesn't do what they want.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I'm not going to.
Hard stare.
We like the reference, but we're not going to do that. If someone punches me, I'm going to dissuade them. I mean, we're going to get into Iran soon, for God's sake. We're not talking about that. If someone punches me, they've got to know that they're not leaving this situation or this provocation without being punched back. Otherwise, they're going to keep coming to me and use me as their emotional punch bag, literally. So I'm not going to have that. I don't know if you're more complacent. No, you're not.
I wouldn't.
No, you just back away. You'd be the bigger person.
I just feel like... Look, this whole bigger person narrative...
That is absolute waffle.
Well, from me...
No, just the people who are saying, oh, to be the bigger person. Yes,
no,
some instances you've got to be the bigger person. But if you're engaged in direct combat, like, why are we debating whether you punch someone? Okay. This retribution idea. If someone punches me, I'm going to punch them back because they've got to know that that is not okay.
Okay.
And they're going to feel the consequences and the punishment for that. That is my rationale behind that. And I think this can also be applied to the death penalty, as controversial as it sounds.
Okay.
Next
policy.
Yes, we're going to the next policy. That's enough for the death penalty. That could be an episode in itself.
Reducing
certain taxes and the size of the state. So, more specifically, they want to obviously cut income tax thresholds. Main policy, they want to abolish inheritance tax. So abolition of inheritance tax, do you support? Yes.
Do I support the abolition of inheritance tax? Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah.
I might,
you can fund it from cuts.
I might okay. In the past
cuts to the welfare.
Just for everyone who's listening, we did a book club and basically I raised inheritance tax and Rory didn't.
But for the record,
I would only abolish it. I don't think that people should have to pay tax on what they receive. Really, I don't think it's right.
Well,
do you not think?
I profoundly disagree with the whole, the main kind of socialist idea of redistribution. Obviously, in mild forms, of course, I support it. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I'm not going to work my ass off just to support someone whose ass is on a sofa the entire day. That's my fundamental belief. Sorry.
What about inheritance tax? Are you just talking about tax?
Well, when I have children, they're going to have every penny that I work for. Like, I'm not going to give it to some depressed idiot who's sitting alone at just watching TV with a bag of crisps, doing nothing with their life.
So your children have the right to obviously have your assets.
Yes.
That's what you're trying to say. Yeah. Instead of just having it, obviously.
That's not being sent to the government who's going to spend it on welfare.
Well, that's why welfare should be cut. We can agree on that.
Yeah. So I don't think, I'm not going to work.
Yeah, I agree on the abolition.
I don't want my parents or my grandparents to be working for lazy idiots who really just don't have a lot.
Well, because that basically takes away the whole incentive to work then. As in, why would you make all that money?
Taking that away, people are going to say, oh, that's just a negative impact. No, that is fundamentally the doom loop that we've gone down. Everyone's, oh, we're going to support off each other. Then the next person is going to support over the next person. And eventually everyone's supporting each other. But that's because they're supporting. I can't really fundamentally explain it. But the fact is, more people are not working, so they need support from a dwindling number of people who are working. So eventually, people are going to get poorer because the people who are making money are supporting the people who aren't making money. So that's reducing their side. That's their buying power, their ability to actually invest and create money. So they're not creating as much money. But the people who aren't creating money at all, they're getting money and they're not doing anything with it. So there's just no point.
Yeah, and I think with obviously with the income tax, I mean, I support a cut.
I support a cut.
Yeah, because I just think
cuts to income tax and cuts to certain spending.
Yeah, I just think that the population shouldn't have to pay large levels of tax, as you mentioned before, just to fund someone who isn't working.
No, I think that's profoundly wrong.
Yeah,
that's your decision. Live with it. You've made your bed. Sit in it or sleep in it. I don't know what they say. Okay, next one.
Next
withdrawing
one.
Public funding from the BBC.
Oh, wait, it's actually quite a good... Withdrawing public... No, I think... No.
I think
we need funding for the BBC.
I think we do. But if you're funding the BBC, I don't know why.
I don't think excessive funding. I just think enough to make sure that it's running smoothly.
I don't need a documentary about panorama of some civil war in far away. Obviously, that's a bad thing, but like...
I think the BBC does well with its coverage.
To be fair, that they do well with their coverage. I don't think we should cut it out. I think it's fine as it is. I think that's more political, a bit more political rather than kind of economic. I think there's another policy, actually, that's probably a bit too controversial to talk about.
Just let me know what it was, though.
Banning the burqa. Expanding legal scope of reasonable force and defence. Stop. Oh, yeah. Banning kosher and halal slaughter. Do you know what halal slaughter is?
I know the concept of halal, yes.
Explain it to me then.
I think it's
halal slaughter. It's halal slaughter, not halal food.
So, okay. All right, wait one second.
So as in you can't, it's not like there can be no halal like jelly in the UK, or there can't be any
halal food in the UK.
I don't think that's what they mean. I think it's the actual practice of halal slaughter, the practice itself, not the actual products.
But why do they want to do that? What's wrong with it? Personally, I think
So some traditions do not stun the animal, but they, with a very sharp knife, cut its throat while it's conscious. I don't know how I feel about that.
I guess it's a tricky one, really. I mean,
Well, that raises all the ethical arguments that you put forward to me earlier.
We're both different religions.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know a lot about Islam, really.
No, I don't either. I don't think I'm in a strong enough position.
So I'd probably steer clear of this one, to be honest.
I'd steer clear. Have you got another? I'll get onto that. The only thing I want to mention is I completely do not endorse an animal having its throat cut while it's sane. I don't think that's correct. But anywho, I don't think that's. Oh, okay.
Well, I guess there's nothing
stopping
we can do about
wokery.
That.
That's your last one.
So repeat that again.
Stopping wokery.
Wokery.
Do you know what wokery
By that
is?
Just mean just woke ideas?
Yes, so I think it's...
what is wokery?
Everyone knows what wokery is, but I just don't know what they mean specifically. What does... Stopping... Oh, okay, we're just doing some live research for you.
Progressive guys. Or left-wing attitudes are...
Stopping woke culture, basically challenging what's perceived as woke elite. Okay. Okay, pushing back against cancel culture. Yeah, I don't think we should have cancel. Cancel culture is quite stupid. Because... Max, are you saying anything?
Sorry?
Are you going to say anything?
I'm researching.
Oh, sorry. Okay, fine.
I'm just trying to figure out what
woke
is.
So, everyone knows what woke means. Woke is basically DEI, Diversity, Equality, Inclusion.
So they want to ban diversity, equality, and inclusion?
They want a meritocracy, which fundamentally I agree with. I mean, I'd rather have... someone put in a... let's use the pilot analogy. I'd rather be on a plane with the pilot being someone who's the best pilot, not the best person who ticks a box. I'd rather have a pilot based on their skill sets. And of course there are overlaps. I'm not saying...
There are good pilots, though, who do... tick the box.
That's what I'm saying. There are obviously overlaps, and that's totally right, but I think what should be more important is a meritocracy. I think someone should be given a job based on how well they'd be able to do it.
Not because of certain characteristics
that other people can't control.
Yeah,
that's unfair. And actually, ironically, that's probably more racist and more homophobic or whatever you want to call it than the actual practice, because that's more discriminatory, because what's discrimination is giving another person a different type of treatment based on some characteristics, and that's the exact same thing. You're giving someone in probably a minority certain privileges because they are that minority. That is discrimination because you're giving them a different service.
Yeah, I think EDI is a tricky one because obviously it's quite important.
Yes, I totally agree.
In that sense, obviously you want to have a welcoming country that's welcome to people of different race, gender, ethnicity, class, and obviously those got protected characteristics in that sense as well. In terms of hiring, I think the way that businesses and companies are doing it now, they need to sort of look at who... Basically, you need to start with a blank slate. You need to look at what skills does this person actually have?
I think skills are more important.
Don't just look at the person and say, or ask them for some sort of form about a potential mental disability or something like that.
Yeah.
You should be hiring someone who's best for the job, because realistically, business is all about
efficiency.
Creating money and efficiency.
Money. That's money.
It's generation. If I ran a business, I would not be winning an award for the most diverse business.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to have, the most efficient business, profit, most profiting business, best at time management, those sort of businesses that...
That's big scale business investment. Yes.
That's what business is all about. But I obviously do think it's good to have representation from certain areas.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when we talk about Spitalfields, and we talk about the Bengali migrants. Obviously, they ran in the 2010 general election. And obviously, it's quite important to have that representation as well.
That's what democracy is, representation.
Yeah, yeah. So that's quite important as well.
Yeah.
Anything else for me?
Let me just do a little... Okay, final thing.
We'll do a final one.
It's not really a policy, but what do you think of Rupert Lowe?
What do I think of Rupert Lowe?
Here's an interesting question, because everyone's going to be like, oh, he's a bit controversial, that lad, isn't he? Would you rather have...
Or would you rather...
So obviously everyone's saying, do you want Polanski or Farage? We're going to take it a step further. Would you rather have Corbyn or Lowe?
Lowe?
I hate Corbyn.
Corbyn? He's a disgrace. He's terrible.
I do not know how he won 40% of the country in 2017.
He blew up the entire Labour Party, okay? He literally...
Thank God.
He got... Boris Johnson completely destroyed him.
Yes.
So I don't...
Good on you, Bojo.
There we go. Okay.
Well, Rupert Lowe, he's a... I mean, as
Rupert Lowe, if we take him against someone like... Obviously, Kemi Badenoch. What was he going to say, Kemi Badenoch, aren't we?
I'd say Farage over Lowe. Actually, oh God, I don't know.
Yeah, okay, that's maybe a debate for another day.
Farage
or
Lowe.
That could be a whole episode. You could compare Reform and Restore and see how similar they really are. Even though that one appears more to the right.
Yeah.
Really, you could say. But would you... Okay, here's a question for you then. Keir Starmer or Rupert Lowe?
Oh, Jesus Christ. That is a debate for another day.
give me an answer.
Okay, I've not thought this through, but I'm going to go with Lowe.
Okay. So this week, we've seen government pressure in the UK, historic political shock in Hungary, and growing fragmentation on the British right. Across all three, the pattern is the same. Politics is becoming less stable, more contested, and harder to predict. The question now isn't just who holds power, but how that power survives scrutiny, challenge, and change. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Ballot, and join us next week as we continue unpacking the forces that shape politics both at home and abroad. Thank you, Rory.
Goodbye.
And see you next time. Bye.